According to credit rating firm TransUnion, the company's new report shows an 8% improvement on timely mortgage payments in the most recent quarter compared to a year ago. Tim Martin of TransUnion says factors include overall increasing economic activity, a growth in the gross national product, plus
the unemployment rate is still stubbornly high, but it's come down a bit. As those macro things come into play, it helps homeowners be able to make and or want to continue making their house payments.
Martin says the mortgage delinquency rate is still well above what would have been considered normal before the housing bust and recession, but he and others expect continued improvement. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, Retirement, Budgeting, Insurance, helping bring clients' finances together at letsmakeaplan.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Farm Doc Project at the University of Illinois, holding a series of five Illinois Farm Economic Summit meetings December 10th through the 14th to discuss and analyze the most pressing economic issues facing Illinois producers. Registration and details at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu.
Good morning. I'm Craig Cohen. This is Focus. And today we're going to dip into the archives to listen back to a program from early September. We'll hear my conversation with author Jim Holt about his book, Why Does the World Exist? As this is on tape, please disregard any requests for calls today, though we do encourage you to post comments on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Never let it be said we don't tackle the big questions on this program. On today's show, we will take on perhaps the biggest of them all. Why are we here? Why does the world exist? Why is there something instead of nothing? Of course, philosophers, religious scholars, theoretical physicists, some of the sharpest minds of our time and of centuries past have contemplated these questions, and for that matter, we probably all have on some level at one time or another in our lives. There are many who seek their answers through science, many who turn to religion. Our guest today believes there's a lot more to consider when grasping the origins of the universe and suggests that many discussions revolving around these questions are maybe too narrow, that there are many more possible answers than the classic God versus the Big Bang debate would suggest. To consider some of these questions knocking around in his own mind, author Jim Holt proceeded to talk with philosophers and physicists, among others. The end result is what he calls an existential detective story. It's his book, Why Does the World Exist? Jim Holt is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times, and he's written on a number of very big subjects, from string theory to the philosophical implications of the concepts of time and infinity. Jim Holt, welcome to Focus.
Hi, nice to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Jim, let's start here. Why is there something instead of nothing?
Well, that's the giving away the punchline of the long joke that is my book. When I began this quest, I really had no idea. I mean, I knew that there was a standard theological explanation that God created the world, that's why the world exists, and God exists through his own nature. I knew that physicists had attempted to answer the question, figures like Stephen Hawking and more recently Lawrence Krauss. And I knew that philosophers had been grappling with it. And so it wasn't until I had traveled all over the place across the United States and to Oxford and Paris and talked with a lot of these thinkers that an answer to the question that went beyond science and beyond religion began to take shape. But perhaps that's something that we should save for a little later, because it's not my own answer, by the way. This is an answer that took shape after I spoke to a brilliant philosopher at All Souls College, Oxford, in England, named Derek Parfit. And he's had some of the most profound thoughts and bits of reasoning on the question, why is there something rather than nothing, which he considers to be the most sublime and awesome mystery that humans can contemplate. So after talking to Derek Parfit towards the end of the book, I saw an answer begin to take shape. And but this was after a long, long quest when I considered the best that religion had to offer, the best that science had to offer. I talked to a very brilliant philosopher of science in Pittsburgh named Adolf Grunbaum, who thought the whole question, why is there something rather than nothing, was sheer nonsense and wasn't worth pursuing. So, there is an answer that does take shape toward the end of the book, and I think it's an interesting mixture of science and philosophy, and I hope that people buy it. I thought I'd run it up the flagpole and see if anyone saluted.
Well, I'll tell you what, since this was a fairly long journey for you, talking with lots of different people, let's start sort of at the beginning of this quest. And I imagine for you, the beginning of it is when it kind of begins for a lot of people, as they start to, maybe in adolescence, start to kind of look around and say, okay, wait a minute, I've been told these stories or these concepts in classrooms, in churches, wherever, but maybe there's a deeper conversation to be had here.
Yeah, exactly. When I was raised in a very devout Catholic family, and so I was told the religious story, which I believed up until, you know, the time when I reached my teenage years. And then I began to get a little skeptical of it and wondered whether, you know, I should believe this, that, you know, this story that I've been told, you know, from my childhood. And so I got interested in, you know, philosophy and existentialism, and I went to the college library, and I found a book called An Introduction to Metaphysics by the great German philosopher Martin Heidegger. And I opened it up, and the very first sentence in the book was, "Why is there something rather than nothing at all?" And so when I encountered that, the mystery of existence struck me as if for the first time. And I should say I was very disappointed when I continued reading the book to find that it shed no light whatsoever on the mystery of existence. It was just a lot of obscure metaphysical noodling, which I hope I haven't done. But the question has haunted me since my teenage years. And interestingly enough, while writing this book, you know, you might consider this a very very esoteric, abstract question, the sort of thing that you might contemplate, you know, at 3 a.m. if you've got insomnia. But while I was writing the book, oddly enough, the question became a hot topic on cable news channels because, you know, the so-called God wars between the neo-atheists, people like Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris, who were, you know, arguing that we should give up religion, we should give up the God hypothesis, and be mature secular atheists. And the religious opponents of the neo-atheists were saying, "Wait a minute, science can explain a whole lot about existence, but it can't explain why there's a world, why there's a universe rather than nothing at all." Remember, Christopher Hitchens was on Sean Hannity's program on, I guess, on Fox News, and Hannity said, "Look, Christopher, you don't accept there's a God. How can you explain why there's a world at all?" And Hitchens didn't really have a good answer to that, and neither does Richard Dawkins. And so I thought, is it just going to come down between, you know, as you said in the introduction, is it just between God and science? Are we thinking about this in too narrow a way? And I thought if I went out there and tried to, you know, drum up some, look for some other cosmic suspects, as it were, I could broaden the debate. And, you know, maybe the question, why is there something rather than nothing, it sounds like a good question that gets at the heart of a mystery, but maybe the question itself is, you know, needs refinement. By the way, I should say also that I was watching Bill Moyers years ago interview the English novelist Martin Amis, mm-hmm. and Martin Amis is, you know, very interested in these cosmological questions himself. And Moyers said, you know, how did this universe that consists of, you know, billions and billions of galaxies, each of which contains billions and billions of stars, how did it come into existence? And Amis said, very wryly, I thought, "I think we're about five Einsteins away from answering that question." And I thought, that's interesting, five Einsteins, that sounds about right, but maybe some of those Einsteins are actually out there. And if I go around and sort of find them and put their thoughts in the right order, some sort of answer might begin to emerge. And maybe the Einsteins aren't all physicists. Maybe some of them are philosophers and theologians, or even, you know, mystics or Buddhists. So that was my modus operandi for this book.
All right. So before we get to the folks that you specifically talked with, I imagine part of this discussion, you have to sort of start with what are the ideas that have already been put forward by some of the great thinkers of centuries past? And these could be philosophers. They could be scientists. Who sticks out when you think of, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, Gottfried Leibniz, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, Albert Einstein, Edwin Hubble, a lot of folks who have contributed to trying to answer elements that surround these big questions?
Yeah, I think that that no real progress, I mean, the first time someone posed the question, why does the world exist at all, why is there something rather than absolutely nothing, that was Leibniz, as you pointed out, in the 17th century. But if you know, and I sort of very briskly traced the history of the problem from, you know, even the Greeks, I should, you know, to go back to the ancient Greeks, they didn't really have a conception of absolute nothingness. To them, the coming into existence of the world was a matter of a primordial chaos, or just a big mess, getting organized into a cosmos. So they didn't really, the Greeks didn't really have a concept of absolute nothingness, and neither did the Romans. You know, it's no mistake that there's no zero in the system of Roman numerals, and the concept of zero didn't even get introduced into Western thought until about the 12th century. It came from India by way of the Arab mathematicians. So the whole idea of absolute nothingness is a pretty, you know, difficult notion to get your head around. I mean, there are all kinds of jokes about the concept of nothing. You know, you say, nothing. The poor man has it, the rich man needs it, and if you eat it for long enough, it'll kill you. You know, so you can generate paradoxes about it all you want. But, has any progress been made? And I don't really think so, even coming into the 20th century. Bertrand Russell, one of the greatest English philosopher of the 20th century, was debating a priest on the BBC in the 1950s. And, you know, Russell was an atheist, and the priest was saying, look, you can't explain why there's a world at all and why we exist if you don't resort to the hypothesis that there's a God. And Russell says, I don't think the world needs a reason for its existence. I think it just is, and that's that. And some people might be satisfied with this answer, but it's interesting that if the universe is eternal, we might just accept its existence as a brute fact and say there's no further explanation. But then, of course, in the 20th century, it was also discovered that the universe that we observe, that consists of about 100 billion galaxies, exploded into existence a finite time in the past, about 13.7 billion years ago, in this event called the Big Bang. So suddenly it looks like, wait a minute, the universe hasn't always been around. There was nothing, and then it exploded into existence 13.7 billion years ago. How did that happen?
So what happened the day before that? That's sort of the thing that everybody thinks about.
It's funny, when the Big Bang theory was introduced in the middle of the 20th century, a lot of physicists thought that it was a religious plot to get God back into the picture. And then, of course, the religious figures like Pope Pius XII rejoiced when the Big Bang theory was brought out, because, you know, he said, it's just like Genesis, let there be light, boom, and there's a world. So, in tracing the history of this question, you can see little glimmers of understanding here or there, but I think it's only really in the last few decades that the thinking on it has gotten really sophisticated.
I want to compare Pope Pius's comments to someone else's comments in just a second. But first, a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest today is Jim Holt, author of the new book, Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. We're just trying to figure out where the universe came from. No big deal. I'm sure it won't take the whole hour. But seriously, we do welcome you to the conversation about some very big cosmic questions. And our guest says the possible answers are much more varied than merely the Big Bang or God. To join us on air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Okay, so let's compare what Pope Pius was saying to the great 20th and 21st century philosopher Bruce Springsteen. He once noted, you can't start a fire without a spark. You know, we can look through the Hubble telescope and we can see what the universe looked like several billion years ago and extrapolate from that pretty darn close, I imagine, to the Big Bang. But no matter how far back we go, no matter if the universe started as one tiny blip of a cell or pixel of light or however you want to describe it, we are always talking about there's something there. So is it even possible that before there was something, there was nothing?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, that physics can do a very good job of explaining how a universe like ours arose from almost nothing. But just, the tiniest little something, as you said, you know, the spark, the cosmic seed, a little tiny patch of false vacuum. It's interesting, by the way, one physicist I spoke to, a Russian physicist who teaches at Stanford named Andrei Linda, who is one of the great figures in the field of physics today. He's the creator of the theory of cosmic inflation, which is the best account of of how the Big Bang might have occurred, and you know, and what banged, and so forth. And Linda says, look, you know, you don't really need very much at all to make a universe. It's all you need is one 100,000th of a gram of matter to create a little bit of false vacuum that could blow up into a universe like ours with 100 billion galaxies. And he said it's actually possible. You know, we talk about whether this universe has a creator. He said it's possible that the creator of our universe is a physicist hacker in another universe who has just a little bit more technology than we do, could easily have, you know, created a universe on his lab bench. And I said, wait a minute. If you create a false vacuum that blows up into a universe in your laboratory, won't that blow up your laboratory? Linda said, no, it doesn't work that way. The new universe you create expands into another set of space-time dimensions. And so to the creator, the universe he created would look like as small as an elementary particle, and then it would disappear. And so I thought, now if I were a physicist hacker and I wanted to create a universe, wouldn't I be a little bit unhappy at the idea that once I created the universe, it would slip out of sight? Couldn't I, you know, if that universe came to contain intelligent creatures like ourselves, wouldn't I want them to know that I had created the universe? And Linda said, well, you know, supposing you wrote on the, you know, on the horizon of the universe you created, remember that I created you. Linda said, under the theory of cosmic inflation, that message would blow up to such an enormous size that the creatures inside the universe would not be able to read it. They would be living in a little corner of one letter. So this all seemed very poignant to me.
I guess I have two initial reactions to all of this. One is that sounds like an excellent episode of Doctor Who, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's not just an episode of Doctor Who. No, he has all the science behind it. Yeah. That's the great thing. It's not written by TV scriptwriters. It's written by one of the most brilliant living physicists.
Well, but the other thought that I have is it still goes back to that same logical kind of conundrum, which is, okay, let's say our universe was created by this physicist hacker in another universe. Well, who created him?
Yeah. It's like the famous incident when Bertrand Russell was giving a lecture in London on cosmology, and he was explaining the scientific understanding of the universe, and a little old lady in the back of the audience said, "Everything you've been saying is absolute rubbish, Professor Russell. The Earth is flat, and it rests on the back of an elephant, a giant elephant, and the elephant is standing on the back of the turtle." And Russell, to humor, said, "And what's the turtle standing on?" And the little old lady said, "It's turtles all the way down." So yeah, I mean, it looks like you've got an infinite regress. If our universe was created by a creator in another universe, who created that universe? Is it an infinite regress or not? And so, we should be able to do better. We should be able to explain how a universe arose from absolutely nothing. That's the hope, you know, what some physicists are saying. And so a guy named Lawrence Krauss wrote a very interesting book called A Universe from Nothing, and he argues that the laws of physics, the laws of quantum field theory, which is our best theory of physics today, ordain that a universe would come into existence out of absolute nothingness. And that's a very interesting, you know, nice try. But what he can't explain is, you know, where do the laws exist? I mean, what gives these laws of physics the power to bring a universe out of nothingness, to tell the abyss that it's somehow pregnant with being? You know, this is a problem that Stephen Hawking wrestled with. Stephen Hawking, in his book A Brief History of Time, and in later books, thought he had a self-sufficient physical explanation of why the world exists in the form of a set of equations. But even Hawking was moved when he said, you know, what is it that breathes fire into these equations and makes a universe for them to describe? He said, why does the universe go through all the bother of existing? So, you know, the greatest physicist that I spoke to in my quest was Steven Weinberg, who was known as the father of the standard model of particle physics. He won a Nobel Prize for unifying the electromagnetic and weak force, two of the four fundamental forces of nature. He's a great, great man. He was at Harvard, now at Texas. And he said, you know, even if we have a final theory of physics, it's not going to dispel the essential mystery of being. So, you know, science can take you only so far, but it still leaves a residual mystery. So I thought, well, if that's true, how do we grapple with this residual mystery? Do we just throw up our hands and say, we'll just have to be mystics and say it's no further progress is made? Or is there some way that maybe by blurring the boundary between philosophy and science, we can achieve further insight and enlightenment?
Well, I want to get back to that residual mystery and talk some more about the folks that you spoke with, but I do want to take a call at this point. We welcome Bruce into the program from Champaign. Bruce, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I have a simple question and should expect a very complex answer, and that is exactly what does the author mean by existence? Is he in saying that, for instance, if God is the creator, then some sense or another, God must be physical? Or is he allowing for that it makes sense, in some sense, to talk about things that are not physical, not material in any way, shape, or form, like Plato's numbers? They exist, and if so, then what do we mean by existence?
Okay, great. Great question. Thanks for the call.
Terrific question. And that's a question I spent a lot of time grappling with in the book and talking to people about. Yeah, I mean, our intuitive idea of existence is that, you know, the world consists of physical stuff, you know, stars and atoms and biological entities and so forth. And it also consists in mind stuff, our consciousness, and the question is, can the mind stuff be explained in terms of the material stuff? And some, you know, thinkers say yes and some say no. I mean, there are aspects to existence, like, you know, the way a strawberry tastes, or the way it feels to be pinched, or something like that, this sort of technicolor consciousness that may not be reducible to just the bumpings around of elementary particles. Yeah, so there, you know, does the world consist just of matter and energy, as some people believe? Does it also exist of mental phenomena that are essentially different from physical phenomena? This, you know, by the way, Descartes, the great French philosopher in the 17th century, said there are two kinds of substance in the world. There's material substance, and there's mental substance. And so he believed that we are essentially mental, and that our consciousness interacts with our bodies through the, you know, pineal gland in the brain, which is a pretty crazy theory. But anyway, so yes, and as the caller said, what about Plato's idea that abstract things like numbers and mathematical entities have an existence that's neither material nor mental? And, you know, curiously enough, there are some very interesting thinkers today who believe that these abstract mathematical ideas that exist necessarily and perfectly and eternally somehow created the physical world, or overflowed or gave rise to or engendered the physical world. And the thinker who believed that, to whom I spoke, was Sir Roger Penrose, a great British mathematical physicist and collaborator with Stephen Hawking on theorems involving the singularity and the beginning of the universe and so forth. So Sir Roger Penrose believes that there is this Platonic reality of mathematical ideas, and that it gave rise to the physical world, which in turn gives rise to brains, which through their infinite complexity give rise to consciousness, and then the consciousness grasps the mathematical ideas that started the whole show off. So it's a really sort of beautiful vision, and Roger Penrose is not the only person who believes that. There's another great physicist at MIT named Max Tegmark, who has a similar Platonic notion. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that I also thought was worth exploring, and it's the sort of thing that sounds, you know, if someone told you that mathematical ideas are eternal and they somehow gave rise to the world we see around us, you might think that person has been, you know, chewing on lotus leaves. I mean, it sounds like a pipe dream. But when you hear these thinkers explain the ideas, it's just extraordinarily, I mean, it gives you such intellectual pleasure and opens up new vistas of thought. So I found it all thrilling.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Jim Holt. He's author of Why Does the World Exist? It's a new book examining how philosophers and physicists, religious theorists, all sorts of people have sought to understand how the universe came to be and why there's something in this world of ours, not nothing. To join the conversation, you can call us at 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or email will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages or on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Before we go any further, let's go back to a name you mentioned earlier, Adolf Grunbaum. You write in the book, if, as Aristotle remarked, philosophy begins with wonder, it ends with Grunbaum. What do you mean by that?
Because Grunbaum is, some people are astonished at existence. You know, the great philosopher Wittgenstein said, you know, how extraordinary that anything should exist at all. It's not how things are in the world that's the mystical, it's that the world exists at all. And there are other people who aren't astonished by existence at all. And one of them was this great philosopher of science in Pittsburgh, who's about in his late 80s now, named Adolf Grunbaum. And he thought the whole idea of wondering why there is something rather than nothing was basically, he's a militant atheist, and he believes that it's essentially it's a way of getting a religious worldview into science through the back door. And he said, you know, why should we be astonished that the world exists? Is there anything that we're more familiar with than existence? What's so great about nothingness? And I said, well, nothingness is the simplest possible reality. And he said, you know, why should simplicity have any say in what reality is like? And, no matter what sort of, strategy I use to convince him that there was a real mystery here, he just brushed it off. And then I should say that later in my encounter with Adolf Grunbaum in Pittsburgh, I myself had a near-death experience, that sort of gave me renewed emotional insight into the possibility of nothingness, and so that kept me on my quest. But I should say that the book is about cosmic existence primarily, about why there's a universe rather than nothing at all. But it's interesting, the question of why the universe exists sort of rhymes with a more personal question: why do I exist? And so, toward the end of the book, I start exploring the possibility that I might not exist in some sense. I mean, what is myself? I mean, I know that I have a physical body and that exists, but what is the self that sort of comes into being and is at the center of my own world and sort of lights it up? When you consider the extraordinary improbability that any of us should have come into existence, and if you look at all the genetically possible humans, there's something like 10 to the 90th power possible genetic combinations, each of which would correspond to a human. And only about, I'd say, 40 or 50 billion humans have existed since the species came into existence. So in a sense, all of us, you and me and the people who've been calling and so forth, we've all won this amazing cosmic lottery. We've come into existence in the face of overwhelmingly negative odds. And so, also, before we came into existence, there was nothingness for us. You know, for the first 13.7 billion years of the universe's existence, there was no you and there was no me. Then suddenly, after this period of nothingness, our little consciousnesses flicker into existence, and they illumine the world for a while, and then they're extinguished, and we go back into a state of nothingness, or so I believe. And so I thought, that toward the end of the book, I sort of grappled with the notion of what is the self? In one sense, do I really exist? And also the idea that the self will flicker into non-existence in the event of death. And so, the last chapter of the book really is about death. And ironically, while I was writing it, my mother was suddenly diagnosed with lung cancer, and she died within a month and a half of the diagnosis. And I was in the hospice room alone with her when she died, and it was just astonishing. I mean, many people who are listening have had this experience of seeing a loved one die, but when you see a being, a self, flicker into a non-existence, and also the very self that engendered your own existence, it fills you with a renewed sense of the sheer weirdness of existence. And so, I think when you began by asking, why wasn't Adolf Grunbaum astonished by existence? It basically comes down to an almost emotional experience, a sense of wonder. And a lot of people think, it's the seat of the religious impulse. The astonishment at existence is the very, you know, it's the essence of the religious impulse.
And yet, you point out in your book, at one point you posed this very question of why is there something instead of nothing to a Zen Buddhist scholar, and he responded by trying to bop you on the head.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess...
He thought it was a Zen koan, I think. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's the way they impart wisdom.
Well, the question... Right, but the question that I wonder is, should we even be preoccupied with this question, or should we just say, you know, live your life and let this one thing remain a mystery, you'll sleep better?
Yeah, but why do that when it's so much fun to explore the mystery? And the mystery touches on so many fascinating things. You know, in between my encounters with these great thinkers, I did my best to give the simplest and most lucid account I could of ideas like the multiverse, eternity, infinity versus the finiteness, how quantum theory can allow something to bubble into existence as a quantum fluctuation out of the void, the arithmetic of nothingness, I call it. You know, so all of it touches on, you know, the nature of space and of time, consciousness. You know, the question one of your caller raised, what exactly is existence? Could the universe really be structured information or structured thought that has no fundamental stuff? And so the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is a way of touching on all of these, you know, these wonderful metaphysical puzzles. And they're not just puzzles. You can make real intellectual progress. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress since the ancient Greeks. You know, they first asked, what is the world made of? And, you know, that sounds like a very naive question, but that question was a very good question because in the course of centuries it got more and more refined and it led to modern science. And so, you know, I hate it when people want to close off debate on something that's interesting by saying, you know, there is no answer, this is a waste of time, it's a fool's errand, it's a snark hunt. You know, maybe so. I think that an answer to the puzzle seemed to take shape toward the end. But even if that answer is no good and readers reject it, I think the quest is, you know, is thrillingly fun.
Well, we'll talk some more about metaphysical puzzles in just a minute. That is, however, now time for a short break. This is Focus.
An election day last Tuesday, Colorado and Washington became the first states to legalize marijuana for recreational use. In the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tony DeCoupil. He's writing a book about marijuana and wrote the recent Newsweek cover story about Colorado and the new pot barons. His father was a marijuana smuggler in the 70s and 80s. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Farm Doc Project at the University of Illinois, holding a series of five Illinois Farm Economic Summit meetings December 10th through the 14th to discuss and analyze the most pressing economic issues facing Illinois producers. Registration and details at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with writer Jim Holt. His new book is called Why Does the World Exist? He calls it an existential detective story, and in it, he travels around speaking with a number of engaging thinkers who attempt to tackle that question and the one that sort of lies underneath it that we've been talking about. Even if you're comfortable with the Big Bang Theory, there had to be something that preceded it, that at some point we went from nothing, a lack of universal existence, if you want to call it that, to something. What caused that? And if, as most religions would suggest, some sort of deity maybe was responsible for that initial, shall we say, divine spark, where did the deity come from? It's a dizzying contemplation, to be sure, but one that I think a lot of us do contemplate over the course of our lives. Next up is Rick. He's in Urbana. Rick, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Mr. Holt. I read your book a couple of weeks ago, and it is a wonderful piece of writing. And I wanted to... I know you interviewed John Updike towards the end of the book. I don't know if it was towards the end of the book per se, but it's in the end of the book. And I love his little thing about the world as a bit of light verse. And to me, that's so literary and so wonderful. But I wanted to ask you also, I think a lot of people should read this book. I don't know whether they'll leave it frustrated or whether they'll actually learn something, because it is a very complex subject. And I think you bring it out very... interestingly, whereas you start out discussing the terminology first, and then you delve into the individuals you interview, and it's hard for me to really, it's probably as much as it is for you, to describe what you wrote. So how do you feel about what you wrote?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for your kind remarks, and I think you're quite right to point to the beauty of John Updike's remarks that he made to me, actually not long before he died. He died of lung cancer a few years ago, and I spoke to him about a year before he died. And John Updike, he wrote a marvelous novel, I believe it was 1986, called Roger's Version, which I commend to all your listeners. I think it's one of Updike's very greatest novels. And in the concluding pages, in the setting is a cocktail party, and he has one character explain to another character how the universe came into existence out of nothing at all through purely scientific means. And this is meant to be, Updike didn't really believe in that, but he gives the most virtuoso account of the scientific idea the best scientific theory of how the world could have come into existence out of nothing in the course of a novel, and it's just a real virtuoso passage. But he didn't believe that. Updike himself was very religious in a strangely non-rational way. We would call him a fideist, I suppose. He believed in God, but he didn't believe there was any rational explanation for God or for religion. He conjured up this idea of God existing in a world of otherwise of nothingness and just being bored. Updike's idea of nothingness was derived from what our universe will look like at an inconceivable point into the distant future, when all of the black holes have evaporated, all of the stars have imploded, all of the protons have decomposed, and basically it's just a neutrino here, and it's separated by the width of our universe from a neutrino over there, just this dismal, empty void. And so he imagines God existing in that sort of void and just being suffering from a sort of divine boredom, and creating the universe really as a way of amusing himself, as a bit of light verse. I'm making him sound a little bit impious here. Updike actually put it much more beautifully than I could, and it's in my book. This is the sort of thing that I think that the question, why is there something rather than nothing, in addition to giving rise to a lot of interesting scientific and philosophical theorizing, is an aesthetically very beautiful question. I should say, by the way, I it may sound as though I've dismissed the religious accounts of existence in this interview, and I certainly give the religious orthodoxy the best possible hearing in the book. And I went to Oxford and spoke to a theologian named Richard Swinburne, who's very astute scientifically and very sophisticated. He's also a philosopher of science, and he gave an account of the idea was that God is the simplest hypothesis that explains not only the existence of the universe, but also the fact that it's fine-tuned for life forms like us to come into being, and many, many other aspects. These arguments have been out there for a while, but Richard Swinburne explains them with such nuance and such beauty. And he actually drew a logical line from the mystery of existence all the way down to Christian orthodoxy, the idea of the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And while I was talking to him, he was sitting in front of a crucifix in his study in North Oxford, and he made the story so compelling, and there was a sort of nimbus of kind of religious glow around him. He seemed actually saintly, and I thought, this is the best account I've ever heard of the traditional Judeo-Christian explanation of existence. And I questioned some of his premises. A key premise is that God is infinitely simple, because the scientific principle is you always reach for the simplest hypothesis to explain something. So he needs the hypothesis that God is perfectly simple. And I said, well, wait a minute. If God is so simple, how does he mirror the complexity of existence? He didn't really have a good answer to that, which was disappointing.
Let me stop you there, just because we have been sort of talking, in part, about the extremes in this sort of never-ending debate about where the universe comes from, and it seems as if so many people in that classic God versus the Big Bang debate seek to disprove the other's view rather than try to align them with one another. Have faith and reason always been at such odds with one another?
Yeah. That's the first of all, it's interesting that, you know, the question, if God does exist and if the universe exists because God created it, why does God exist? And Richard Swinburne, the theologian I was just talking about, said that's something that can't be explained. If, you know, if, as I believe he said, God exists, God's own existence has no reason for it. It's just a brute fact. And that made me wonder, you know, could God himself ponder the question, you know, why, whence then am I? Why do I exist? Which seemed a sort of a astonishing thing. But I don't, faith and reason, the medieval philosophers like Aquinas and St. Anselm tried to prove the existence of God by using sheer logic. There's this argument that I talk about in the book called the ontological argument for God's existence. And by the way, neo-atheist thinkers like Dawkins and hate this argument because to them it sounds like, they call it verbal prestidigitation. You know, it's just abracadabra with words. And that may be true, but it's, you know, it is logically interesting to parse the argument. Bertrand Russell himself, by the way, the ontological argument in a nutshell says God is by definition the greatest being that can be conceived. It's greater to exist than not to exist. Therefore, God must exist. Now, you know, stated in that stark way, it's an absolutely unbelievable argument. But it can be made very, very subtle and sophisticated. And in fact, there's a guy at Notre Dame named Alvin Plantinga, a very distinguished logician and philosopher, who thinks he's come up with a version of the ontological argument that relies on something called modal logic, which we don't have to talk about now. It's the logic of necessity and possibility. And he thinks he's, you know, got a logically valid version of it. So I this is worth paying attention to. It doesn't convince me, but it's awfully interesting, and it just expands your mind to try to see what's wrong with it.
If we ever actually do find out the answer to these kinds of questions, aren't such answers likely to be a bit of a disappointment? I mean, to take the science fiction sort of extreme viewpoint of this, think of Deep Thought and Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, concluding that the answer to life, the universe, and everything is 42 and not explaining any further. Wouldn't an actual unimpeachable answer, whether found through science or religion or philosophy or everyone just suddenly collectively figuring it out and agreeing on it, how could that answer compare to the breadth of all of humanity posing their own theories?
Yeah, I mean, in particular, the answer that I grope my way towards, which was suggested by the Oxford philosopher Derek Parfit I mentioned earlier, has a very ironical and deflating conclusion. I won't go into the details here, but essentially you combine the scientific principle of simplicity, the idea that you always reach for the simplest hypothesis to explain the data, and the philosophical principle of fullness, which goes back to Plato, a principle of plenitude, that existence should be as full as possible. And the odd thing is, if you mix these together and you sort of do the logic in the way that this Oxford philosopher suggests, the conclusion you come to is that that reality should take the form of essentially an infinite mediocrity, a cosmic junk shot, that the universe should be, the reality should be infinitely removed from absolute nothingness, but it should fall infinitely short of everything that could possibly be. It should be meaningful in some regions and meaningless in others. It should be mathematically elegant in its underlying laws to some extent, but also very inelegant and messy in other ways. And by the way, this is, you know, more and more borne out by discoveries we've been making in physics, like the discovery of the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson, the function of the Higgs boson is essentially to make the universe a messier place than it would otherwise be, because the Higgs boson, I'm racing through this in a way that no one will be able to make sense of, but the Higgs boson corresponds to the Higgs field, which breaks the symmetry and causes some particles to have mass and other particles to be massless. And so it makes the universe a messier place than it would otherwise be. The universe should be this basically corresponds to the universe that we see. I mean, the universe contains goodness and contains horrible evil, the Holocaust and child cancer and, you know, the wasted galaxies and so forth. But in many ways, it's very beautiful. So it's this mixture of beautiful and ugly, of good and bad, of elegant and inelegant, of emptiness and fullness. And so that's not a bad preliminary conclusion. And I think it's quite interesting that this idea that the reality is a cosmic junk shot and infinite mediocrity does proceed from these very lucid principles of simplicity and of fullness.
Well, and interesting, you mentioned this question of good and evil. You spoke with this cosmologist, a guy named John Leslie, who seemed to suggest that the intention behind the origins of our universe are the reason it came to be, that the world is basically good and that it was created by the need for the existence of a good world.
Yeah. Another idea that on the face of it sounds a bit crazy. And John Leslie, this Canadian cosmologist, defends his idea that he calls it axiarchism, the idea that the reason for the world's existence is that it's better it's better than nothing, essentially. I mean, he sees our world as being part of a much larger cosmic ensemble that consists of essentially infinitely many minds contemplating, all of the everything that's interesting to contemplate. And so I said, well, wait a minute. If you think our world came into existence in answer to an abstract need for goodness, why does it fail to be good in so many ways? And he said, well, look, it's like the Louvre Museum. You don't want every painting in the Louvre to be the Mona Lisa. That would be boring. So in addition to the best possible painting, the Mona Lisa, you have a lot of paintings that are less good and some that are, just barely good enough to be in a museum at all. And the reality that we see around us, our observable universe, is like one of those mediocre paintings. Even though it's mediocre, it's still better than nothing. And so it adds to the total sum of cosmic goodness. This was his idea. And I said, but how can it, even if I grant you that our universe is better than nothing, why does its, little bit of goodness, how could that cause it to exist? And he said, well, there's nothing fighting its existence. If there's no reason our world shouldn't exist, then the weakest reason for its existence should be existentially sufficient. And, I thought, that's an interesting argument. I don't quite buy it. But what I, came away with after speaking to John Leslie, the Canadian cosmologist who believes that goodness explains the existence of the world, is I never thought such a daft-sounding idea could be made so intellectually compelling. And even in rejecting it, I feel I learned a lot. I said, okay, maybe if the principle behind existence isn't goodness, it could be another principle like that, only more abstract. And so, it gave me further momentum in this quest.
Are there moments, because you spend so much time, obviously, investigating and exploring these kinds of big questions and having these sorts of conversations, is there a point where you say to yourself, man, this is exhausting to constantly contemplate cosmic questions as opposed to just deal with some, pretty simple, basic stuff, your day-to-day life? Are there moments where you say, man, I got to take a break from this?
I took many breaks during the book, and I think I annoyed some readers and amused others by talking about what was going on in my travels where I was hanging out in Paris and the unfortunate interactions I was having with snooty French waiters and the famous people I was running into and, the personal events in my life. Well, when I went to Texas to interview Steven Weinberg, I left my little long-haired miniature dachshund with some friends, and the dog had a seizure while I was gone, and I had to race back and attend the ultimate euthanasia of my dog, which was one of the sad, it's pathetic to say this, it's one of the saddest days of my life, and sort of foreshadowed the death of my mother at the end, and the death of John Updike, and even that I also write about the great French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, and just before I began writing the book, I went to his 90th birthday party in Paris at the Collège de France, and he gave the most moving speech about the dissolution of his self, now that he's not, he died at the age of 102, finally, but at the age of 90, he said, there's so little of myself left that I feel that, you know, the transition into nothingness will be, you know, an almost infinitesimal one. And I'm not doing justice to his words, but, you know, all of this was tremendously moving. So, yes, I mean, I was being driven by intellectual curiosity, and I was grappling with all of these ideas and trying to, you know, trade wits with these great thinkers. But I was also living my life, and a lot of interesting things happened to me, and I tried to, you know, put in novelistic color touches, and some people found them entertaining, and as I said, some readers, I think, found them annoying. But I hope they're not too obtrusive in the book.
Well, I'm afraid we've just about come to the end of our time here, and I don't think we answered our question. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Well, we tried. And, you know, the fact that we tried and perhaps failed, as Steven Weinberg says, it gives life some of the grace of tragedy. And maybe that's the best we can hope for.
Jim Holt is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and a frequent contributor to The New York Times, and he's written on a number of very big subjects. His newest book is Why Does the World Exist? Jim, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey, and as I go ahead and prepare to get ready to look at the markets and compute and clicking on the old computer, got to enter the old password here. And we'll see what the markets have to offer here this hour in just a second. We did see that earlier in the day, as we entered the open outcry session initially, we had some strength, but we gave much of those gains back that we saw in the overnight market. And let's go ahead and look and see where we are at the moment. We continue to go on the downslide as the day moves on here. And as I check in on the Chicago Board of Trade informational talks, we see that the futures were initially mixed, but now to the downside. Soybeans are attempting to stabilize after what has been a couple of rough days if you are a soybean bull in the marketplace, especially given that we saw the crops significantly increase in its size on Friday's WASDE reports. Even though ending stocks didn't change all that much, we did see a lot of follow-through to the downside yesterday. Question became then who was going to be willing to buy into this market, speculators exiting their long positions, while also the commercials sitting on the sideline waiting to see where the price's lows were going to be. So we've seen speculative selling in that market in the last couple of days. Wheat futures lower too. We're still lingering worries about slow export demand limiting buying in that market. And corn also has had a couple of rough days, although this morning's export sales report reporting a pretty significant sale of corn to unknown destinations for the 12 and 13 marketing year, perking up that market some and actually providing some stabilization above the 705 and 715 technical levels that many analysts are suggesting are benchmarks of support. Let's go ahead and look at some of the marketplaces and see what is going on. In Kansas City, December hard red winter wheat is trading 886 and a quarter. It's down 4 and a quarter. March is at 903 and a quarter, and it is down 4. In the May contract, 909 and a quarter, down 4 and three quarters. December wheat in Chicago's 848, down 9 and three quarters. March 13 at 862 and a half, down 10. May 869 and a half, down 9 and three quarters. December corn, 714 and three quarters, down 3 and a quarter. March at 718 and a half, down 3 and three quarters. May 715, down 4 and a half. July at 705 is down 5 and a quarter. And September 13 is at 631. It's down 3. Go out to the December contract. It's at 607 and three quarters, down 4 and a half. November soybeans are 14.08 and a quarter, down 2 3/4. January, 13.98 and a quarter, down 6 3/4, now down 6.5. March, 13.76 3/4, down 11 1/4. May, 13.62 1/4, down 13 1/4. November, 13 is 12.79, down 6 3/4. December soybean meal, 4.29, now 4.28.70, down 2.70. December soybean oils, 47.19, down 20. December live cattle, 125.55, up 20 cents. November feeder cattle, 143.40, and it is down 60 cents. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. The time now is 11 o'clock Central Time.
From WHY.